And now, it's time for our weekly news round, Lutheran Radio News, with Paul Hill.
A German court is to decide the fate of an anti-Semitic medieval Jew's sow carving on the facade of the Church of Martin Luther after a Jewish campaigner sued for its removal. Dating from 1305, the Judensau at St. Mary's in Wittenberg depicts a rabbi holding up the tail of a large pig to inspect its rear while two Jewish children suckle underneath it. The sandstone relief is one of many similar anti-Semitic images installed at German churches during the Middle Ages. Councillors at the town in eastern Germany voted last summer to retain the carving after a petition to remove it gained more than 5,000 signatures. The court case, which has been referred to the Saxony-Anhalt State Court, was brought by Michael Dullman, a member of a synagogue in Berlin. Mr. Dullman said Jews were degraded by the carving and proposed that it be sent to a museum where it could be viewed with explanations of its origins. The church and the town argued that the carving should stay as a reminder of the historical prejudice of the kind that led to the Holocaust, which is also commemorated at the church. Johannes Block, pastor at St. Mary's, said the church was appalled and affected by this part of its heritage. "We must weigh up how to treat this history," he said. "So far, we are convinced we should show history, not hide history, and deal with the negative so that something positive comes off it." Archaeologists in Israel have uncovered an ancient site that may offer fresh insight into the ancient biblical kingdom of David and Solomon. Researchers from Bar-Ilan University have been excavating the remains of a large house dubbed the Governor's Residence that was destroyed by a fire in an 8th century BC Assyrian military campaign. The impressive four-room home located at Tel Ethan in the Judean foothills had at least two stories and its ground floor extended over 2,420 square feet. Occupying high ground at the top of a mound, the house was carefully built with deep foundations. Large masonry stones were placed in the corners and entrances of the building and high-quality building materials were used, according to experts. The discovery could shed new light on the joint kingdom ruled by David and his son Solomon, which is described in the Hebrew Bible and has long divided historians. Also known as the United Monarchy, the territory is said to have included the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. While some experts believe that the kingdom existed in the 10th century BC, others have questioned its existence, citing a lack of evidence of royal construction at the center of the region where the kingdom is said to have existed. However, part of the building at Tel Etan has been dated to a period in history that coincided with the supposed joint kingdom, according to Professor Avraham Faust and Dr. Yair Sepia. The archaeologists recently published their findings in the journal Radiocarbon. Surprisingly, radiocarbon dates from within the floor makeup and from within a foundation deposit that was placed below the floor indicate that the building had already been erected in the 10th century BCE between the late 11th century and the third quarter of the 10th century BCE. This date is in line with other finds related to the construction, like the foundation deposit itself, said Professor Faust in a statement. The construction of such a major residence at the top of a mound with commanding views over the local area marks an important event in the site's history, according to Faust and Sapir, particularly when viewed in the context of the ancient city's growth. However, the archaeologists note that the association with David is not based on direct archaeological evidence, but solely on circumstantial grounds. Nonetheless, the erection of the residence and the growing size of Tel Etan could make a link to David plausible, the researchers say, noting that the king is said to have existed in the nearby Judean highlands. The Archbishop of Canterbury is taking inspiration from a Stormzy song as he nervously prepares for Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's wedding. The Most Reverend Justin Welby will officiate the highly anticipated ceremony on May the 19th, but even the Church of England's most senior cleric is not safe from the nerves of the big day. Speaking on BBC Coventry and Warwickshire, he told of how he is preparing for the ceremony. Mr. Welby said, "I'm always nervous at weddings because it's such an important day for the couple, whoever they are. I've made a couple of cack-handed mistakes over the last couple of weddings I've been involved in, and I'm thinking this is probably not a good moment to make it a hat-trick." He has previously admitted to fearing he might drop the ring during the service. When asked by presenter Lorna Bailey how he's preparing himself, the Archbishop said a line from grime artist Stormzy's song Blinded by Your Grace was helping him in the run-up to the nuptials. Mr. Welby explained, there's a line in that, I stay prayed up and get the job done. I think that sort of sums it up. The Archbishop, who is second most senior figure in the Church after the Queen, who is Supreme Governor of the Church of England, has already had an instrumental role in preparing Ms. Markle for the wedding. In March, he officiated as she was baptised and confirmed into the Church in a secret ceremony, describing it as beautiful and very special. The Mormon Church will sever all ties with the Boy Scouts of America by the end of 2019. Its remaining 425,000 boys will be placed into a gospel-focused youth program that is currently under development. The move that was announced by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on Tuesday ends a nearly century-old relationship that was based on their shared values. But it didn't come as a complete surprise after the religion last year removed 185,000 boys between the ages of 14 and 18, signaling that an end to the long-time alliance was near. Joining the Boy Scouts is practically automatic among Mormon boys, and the religion has long been the biggest sponsor of Boy Scout troops in the United States. The Mormon boys who will be leaving represent about 18.5% of the 2.3 million youth in the organization. In a statement, the Mormon Church said the move is about creating its own youth program that it can use for its increasingly global membership, but the two organizations' values clearly have been diverging in recent years. The Boy Scouts decided in 2015 to allow gay troop leaders and announced last year that it would allow girls in its ranks. Last week, the organization said it will change the name of its flagship program next year to Scouts BSA to account for the inclusion of girls. Like other conservative faiths, the Mormon Church opposes gay marriage and teaches that being in a homosexual relationship is a sin. The church initially said it was deeply troubled by the Boy Scouts' policy change on gays, but stayed with the organization after receiving assurances it could appoint troop leaders according to its own religious and moral values. The religion has also traditionally used separate youth programs for boys and girls. In 2020, the Mormon Church will start its new program that will help all girls and boys, young women and young men, discover their eternal identity, build character and resilience, develop life skills and fulfill their divine roles as daughters and sons of God. The still-to-be-developed program that will likely include outdoor activities and character building, similar to Boy Scouts, but it won't be modeled after Boy Scouts or youth ranks. The 14 to 18-year-old boys that left the Boy Scouts already focus on church-related activities and community service. More than half of the church's 16 million members live outside the US and Canada. The Boy Scouts of America, in a statement, thanked the thousands of Mormons who have served as Scout leaders and wish the religion well in its new program. The organization said individual Mormons who wish to stay in Boy Scouts would be integrated into other troops. The Boy Scouts move to allow girls, announced last October, marked the organization's latest momentous policy shift. The Catholic Church needs to seek the input, commitment and talents of all its members if it's to be truly Catholic and to evangelize effectively, said a new document from the International Theological Commission. Pope Francis has called for the Church to be synodal, which does not just mean holding regular meetings of the World Synod of Bishops, but constantly finding ways to live and work in the world with a greater sense of the value of prayers, experience and advice of everyone in the Church, including lay people, the document said. Synodality in the Life and Mission of the Church was published in early May with the approval of Archbishop Louis Ladaria, Prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and the authorization of Pope Francis. The International Theological Commission is a board of theologians appointed by the Pope who advise the doctrinal congregation. The new document explored Pope Francis's frequent calls for the Church to be synodal or characterized by walking together as the pilgrim people of God. The theologian said the synodal attitude flowed naturally from the Second Vatican Council's description of the Church as a communion and its emphasis on the responsibility of all Catholics for the Church's life and mission, although each person has been given different gifts and roles by the Holy Spirit. While synodality is based on the baptismal gifts and responsibilities of each Catholic, the document said, it is not a call for some form of a Catholic parliament. The Pope and the bishops, assisted by the priests, still retain their decision-making authority. But the participation of the lay faithful is essential, the document said. They are the vast majority of the people of God, and there is much to learn from their participation in the various expressions of the life and mission of the ecclesiastical community, in popular piety and in pastoral work as a whole, as well as from their specific competence in the various spheres of cultural and social life. Any process of church discernment, the theologians wrote, should begin with the consultation of the laity, and for that to be effective, laymen and laywomen must be given more opportunities for education in the faith and more spaces in the church where they can learn to express themselves. Greater effectiveness also requires overcoming a clerical mentality that risks keeping them at the margins of church life, the document said. Calling for conversion for a renewed synodality, the document emphasized the need for all church members to be better educated in the spirituality of communion and the practice of listening, dialogue, and communal discernment. Without a conversion of hearts and minds, it said, the existing structures of synodality will be simple masks without heart or a face. Because the Holy Spirit works within all the baptized, it said, the renewal of the synodal life of the church requires activating processes of consultation with the whole people of God, including laymen and laywomen. A Coptic Christian woman who has been married for just 2 weeks went missing from her school last Wednesday, sparking fears that she may have been kidnapped. Her disappearance brings to 8 the number of Coptic women in Egypt who have gone missing since April, according to research by World Watch Monitor. Vivian Adele Youssef, 18, from the village of Dash in Minya Governorate, married her cousin Hannah Emmed on 19th of April and moved to his village in Minya. Prior to that, they had been engaged for 2 years, her husband Hannah told World Watch Monitor. On the 2nd of May, Emmed drove Vivian to a secondary school of commerce for 16 to 18-year-old students in the city of Semilut so that she could do some paperwork for her forthcoming exam while Emmed left to go shopping. He'd arranged to pick her up later. After I finished my shopping, I called Vivian and asked her to wait for me at the front of the school, Emmed said. When I reached the school, I didn't find her there. Her mobile phone was switched off. I searched for her everywhere, in the school, in the nearby streets, in the hospitals of Semilut, but I didn't find her. I checked with her relatives and friends, but none of them saw her that day. The next day, Emmed filed a report on his wife's disappearance at Semilut police station, but has not received any information about her so far. In Egypt, a person cannot be reported missing unless his or her whereabouts have been unknown for more than 24 hours. The woman's disappearance follows a number of similar incidents raising fears of a fresh spate of kidnappings of Coptic women that have sent fear through Egypt's Christian minority communities. We love each other very much, Emmet told WWM. On the day of our wedding, all of us were very happy. After our marriage, we spent a very happy time, 2 weeks. He said he did not believe she would have run away. There wasn't any dispute between us. I'm sure that Vivian was kidnapped. She is very religious and has a very strong relationship with God, and she loves me very much, he added. The priest of Mar Gurgis Coptic Orthodox Church in Vivian's village, Father Basilus Yunan, affirmed Vivian's husband's account. Vivian was one of the good members of our church, he said. In a separate incident, a 16-year-old Coptic Christian girl, Myrna Malak Shinoda, reported that she had been kidnapped by 2 women and a man in Aswan, Upper Egypt. She managed to escape her kidnappers, her father, Malak Shinoda, told WWM. The girl's family did not report her missing because she returned home within 24 hours. Malak Shinoda said his daughter headed off in the direction of Amber Shinoda, Coptic Orthodox Church, on the 4th of May, and when she did not return an hour later as expected, the family started calling her, but calls to her mobile phone did not connect. Priests and young people told Shinoda that Myrna had not been there that day. Myrna later told her family that 2 women and a man on a tuk-tuk or an auto rickshaw sprayed strong anesthetics on her face when she was on her way to the church. After kidnapping her and fleeing the scene, they took the train to Cairo. When Myrna woke on the train, she pretended to be unconscious and made a plan to escape. When the train stopped at the nearest station, she quickly got off the train and left her kidnappers behind. And finally, an inexperienced pastor was to hold a graveside burial service at a pauper's cemetery for a man with no family or friends. Not knowing where the cemetery was, he made several wrong turns and got lost. When he eventually arrived an hour late, the hearse was nowhere in sight, the digger was next to the open hole, and the workmen were sitting under a tree eating their lunch. The diligent young pastor went to the open grave and found the vault lid already in place. Feeling guilty because of his tardiness, he preached for an impassioned and lengthy service, sending the deceased to the great beyond in style. As he returned to his car, he overheard one of the workmen say to the other, "I've been putting in septic tanks for 20 years, and I've never seen anything like that."
My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you, and goodbye for now.
On your PC, tablet, mobile phone, and internet radio receiver, this is Lutheran Radio UK.